Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts President and CEO, and yours, David Patrick Stearns on the rise and fall of the Pottstown Symphony Orchestra. Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at the historic role of the theatre director. We'll hear from the Wilma Theatre's Blanca Ziska and Seth Rosen of the Interact Theatre. And Susan Lewis visits several area carillons, large musical instruments of bells that live at the top of tall towers. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In April, just 9 months after Anne Ewers became its CEO and president, the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts announced that it would retire its construction debt thanks to the help of local foundations, contributions from its board, city and state grants, and a large gift from Sidney Kimmel, for whom the center is named. Although shortly after her appointment, Ewers had promised that the center's financial solvency was her top priority, many thought that the elimination of the Kimmel's debt would take years. I met with Anne Ewers earlier this week to find out how she did it. When we spoke less than a year ago, you said that you were going to get rid of the debt, and soon. And my reaction, and I'm sure a lot of people's reactions, was, well, good luck with that. Then when you announced that you had gotten rid of the debt, the reaction was, wow. So can we go to the third stage and ask, how did you do it?
Sure. You know, I have to really credit, there are so many people, you know, it's one of these, success has a thousand authors, and everyone stepped forward. And I have often said that a lot of people for a long time have been tugging on this jar lid, and I happened to be the one that came along at the time that we could open it. I think it certainly starts with our board. There had been complaints, primarily from the foundations, but others, indicating that our board personally was not giving enough. And mind you, these board members over time had given to the original capital campaign, the original endowment. And when I heard the perception, I said, okay, team, we need to make a statement. We need 100% participation. And we need to take this action and be done in 100 days. So that marvelous board came up with personal money, $13.7 million, which is nothing short of extraordinary, given the fact that some of them are still paying off pledges from the previous campaigns. When I arrived, the organization had raised already a $40 million endowment, which is no small feat for a young organization. Add the $13.7 million from our board. Sidney Kimmel, on top of that, pledged $25 million. Then the city came forward with a $2 million gift directly identified for capital. Our marvelous governor came up with, yet again, another gift from the Commonwealth, $5.5 million, to be matched one-to-one. And so that brings us to the $13 million total. As we look at our out years, our budgeting is possible between now and 2012 to garner that 5.5 match to the governor. So that is in place. So with all of those things having been done, we respectfully requested of the four foundations $30 million to completely retire the debt.
So now you wake up in the morning and you go to work safe in the knowledge that your job is not primarily that of servicing a debt.
Indeed. It puts us at ground zero, which is a much better place to be than the negative $30 million. And it really is a new day for the Kimmel Center. I think that we are poised. We are ready to take off. We can now do what the organization was always intended to do, and that is to be a catalyst for collaboration, for creativity, to really be a destination for our region. This is the go-to place, and now we can do it.
Let's go back over some of the other plans you had in place, and that was obviously the most ambitious. The others were, you talked about it being a go-to place, and one of the long-time complaints was about the use of Commonwealth Plaza, of the entrance hallway. Any progress on that? And then as a second part of that question, any progress on, because we are now in a 7-year-old building, which doesn't sound too terrible, but it is a building that requires a lot of maintenance.
It does. Well, the beautiful thing is the collaboration that we've just, we're just now wrapping up with Penn Praxis. We were the project for the students from Penn and UArts through the entire spring. They, as their assignment, address the outside of the building, Commonwealth Plaza, and the rooftop garden. So that has been amazing because they have come up with some very creative ideas. This will be presented to our board actually this week. And then we will do a feasibility study. What of these suggestions can we do immediately? What are things that will take more time? What are things that are lovely but not quite doable in the plan of the organization? But all of it addresses the issues of needing to be warmer, needing to be more inviting, needing to be a meeting spot, needing to be available to people and accessible to people. And so I think people will be very pleased. We had some wonderful focus groups who were passionate, and I love that. People own this building, and they should. This is their building. This is the building for the community. So great suggestions from people that fed into what the students did. And what was wonderful in all of that is the students became acquainted with the building, and I'm hoping that that helps us draw in a younger crowd. We are a very cutting-edge building. We've only existed for 6 years. We need to be someone who responds to younger generations, and so I'm hoping that some of these ideas from the Penn Praxis project will draw a younger clientele into our building.
President and CEO of the Kimmel Center, Ann Ewers. The Kimmel's final major presentation of the season is the day-long summer solstice celebration a week from today. There at 7 p.m., we'll record a segment for broadcast on this program on the state of the arts in Philadelphia. Gathered in the Kimmel's Rendell Room will be Ann Ewers, Philadelphia Theatre Company producing artistic director Sarah Goronczyk, Pennsylvania Ballet's Michael Scolomero, and choreographer and dancer Renee Harris. The event is free and open to the public, and the discussion will air on this program on June 28th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The music heard in this late March concert was meant to signify a breakthrough in the Pottstown Symphony Orchestra's upward trajectory during its 6 years under conductor Rosalind Irwin. Instead, the performance was a prelude to a breakdown between the orchestra's board and its artistic team. In recent weeks, Irwin, three board members, and executive director Kevin Wood have resigned in frustration over a financial situation that should have been remedied long before it got out of hand. Now the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns looks at the rise and fall of the Pottstown Symphony.
It was a cold, rainy night late last year when I walked into a Pottstown Symphony Orchestra rehearsal, having been tipped off by a recording company executive that special things were going on there. What I heard wasn't just good. Many orchestras in the region play remarkably well these days, thanks to the artistic ripple effect from Philadelphia and New York City. But what I heard that night in an auditorium inside the famous Hill School was a fresh, minted approach to the usual standard repertoire, and one that quelled any discussion of why we need a Pottstown Symphony Orchestra when the August Philadelphia Orchestra is just down the road. There can never be too much committed music making in this world, particularly in a town of just 22,000 that's been traumatized by departing industry. Though ex-music director Rosalind Irwin wonders if Pottstown really got it.
Any community is deserving of a quality expression of Western culture, be it a symphony orchestra, be it an outstanding choir, be it an outstanding theater organization. But music, it's so integral to our being. I'm not certain that everybody understood the definition of what a regional orchestra really meant. And I don't know that everybody was on the same page. You're going to have expenses, a commitment. You're going to understand that this is a business and that it's going to take work.
At present, the Pottstown Symphony Orchestra has an estimated $150,000 debt against operating funds that last season were around $425,000. A fundraising concert for the orchestra that was to take place at Pottstown's newly reopened Sunnybrook Ballroom with a Brian Pastor big band was canceled due to poor promotion, leaving the band leader with only half of his promised fee. These are not things that Board President Kay Doherty wanted to talk about in detail in a recent phone conversation. She admitted to a deficit, declined to say how much it was, and pointed out that many orchestras operate in the red. The dire picture painted by some was not substantiated by Doherty. She expressed great admiration for ex-music director Irwin. It's hard to find anyone who doesn't. But she's booking guest conductors for the forthcoming season, which hasn't been organized yet but will be in the coming weeks. She predicted no curtailment of activities or musicians' salaries, but this is a situation where, in the past, Irwin donated part of her fee to cover orchestra payroll. Though many economically challenged cities have found symphony orchestras to be an epicenter of urban renewal, any orchestra with a deficit is going to have trouble raising funds from foundations and corporations. Executive Director Kevin Wood landed sponsorship from the Siemens Corporation last year, but closer to home has long been a different story.
I saw no support from the borough. There was some talk of money from local governments. Certainly there was money from Montgomery County. There was money from the state of Pennsylvania. But in terms of Pottstown Borough itself, I cannot recall ever having seen any money, certainly any significant money during my time, having come in. Possibly before I was there it did, but not during my tenure.
Even a consortium of Pottstown restaurants that offered special rewards to Symphony ticket holders fell apart after a year. Right before the 07-08 season, that promised more attractive performances than ever. The offering of 9 orchestral and chamber music concerts, plus a young artist competition and various outreach events, climaxed with Rachmaninoff's sumptuous but challenging Symphony No. 2.
I felt that this would be an opportunity for this orchestra to finally congeal, to really have made that second or third step up the ladder and really have been able to show its community and actually to illustrate to the orchestra itself what it was capable of doing. Unfortunately, the week of the concert, it became very apparent to me that the financial issues had just become unbearable. So I stood up in front of that orchestra kind of with the feeling that this might be the last time we get together. Whereas I wanted it to be a joyous event, because that Rachmaninoff symphony is not easy, it became almost a bit of a requiem, at least for me, because I was looking at something that just might not ever be again.
You wonder if there's anything that could put the orchestra back on its previous track. No, says Kevin Wood.
I don't believe that's possible. I think there are too many extra organizational factors that would keep that from becoming what it once promised to have become.
In smaller communities, great music is often sustained by the efforts of people who are willing to go to extraordinary lengths. This is one area of society when the individual can make a to-be-or-not-to-be difference in local cultural life. But there are limits, and the Pottstown Symphony is finding out the hard way where those limits lie.
Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns. In any given theater production, many people affect how a show looks, sounds, and feels. The actor, costume designer, set designer, sound designer. But other than the playwright, perhaps no one has more sway over a production than its director. Now, as part of our continuing series on what it takes to bring theater to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of the director.
The theater director, in the modern sense of the title, really hasn't been around very long. The role is thought to have emerged in the mid-1800s in Germany. Before then, playwrights like Shakespeare or a lead actor fulfilled the basic functions of a director, coordinating the logistics of staging a show. But as theater arts evolved over the centuries, so did the need for a lead visionary, the director.
I think the director has a duty to interpret the text.
Wilma Theater co-artistic director Blanca Ziska has been directing in Philadelphia for nearly 30 years. In her view, the job is about bringing together the best possible actors and designers, and on the basis of what the playwright has written, the text, overseeing the live presentation of the story on stage. A typical script communicates a limited amount of information, generally the dialogue and perhaps some basic stage direction. The director of the play, then, is left to make an infinite number of choices on how to interpret the script. For Blanka Ziska, the first significant choice is deciding whether or not to even dive into any given work.
Choosing a play, it means that I'm really putting 6-7 months of my life into it, and I want that to be exciting and fulfilling 6 months. So it's always very, very difficult to commit. It's like marriage for 6 months.
Part of building this marriage is finding the right partners, in particular the designers and the actors of the show. Seth Rosen, founder and artistic director of the Interact Theater in Philadelphia, has been directing for well over 20 years. He says assembling the right performers is among the most important set of decisions a director will make.
Because if you cast the right actors, you're really halfway there, and if you don't cast the right actors, you've got a big job ahead of you. The best director can't get great work out of the wrong actors, and a bad director will have to work real hard to screw up the work of really good actors.
The audition process, according to Blanka Ziska, is difficult for both directors and actors.
It's a hard process for actors because you have to put your best during those 10 minutes of auditions, and for director too, because you have to find the right person for the right role.
Once the actors and designers are assembled and the planning and rehearsals begin, the director must then lead the team. This not only means having a strong vision for how the production should unfold, but also communicating that vision to a wide variety of people, which can be as basic as telling actors where to go on stage. Seth Rosen likens it to being a traffic cop.
It's no simple matter sometimes to figure out how to make the movement of the play seamless and attractive and satisfying.
While a director coordinates and guides the process of bringing a play to life, in the end, creating theater is a team effort. How open different directors are to input from others in the team varies, but Seth Rosen says wise directing is not a dictatorial one-way street.
And if you treat it that way, your actors will either shut down or revolt.
Temple University Theater Department Chair and longtime director Roberta Sloan says it takes sensitivity to get the best out of everyone.
Different actors work at different rates. You have to have great tolerance for individuality and be able to work with that.
Many directors started out as actors, and for them, it's perhaps easier to empathize with the common struggles of performers. Whit McLaughlin, artistic director of Philadelphia's New Paradise Laboratories Theater Company and a freelance director in the region, says his 25-year acting career prior to being a director helps him understand how a lot of actors think.
And I also know that they say they like to be pushed, but they don't always really mean it. And so you have to come up with ways to challenge actors to break out of their kind of habitual, cliched kinds of ways of thinking.
Besides coaching skills, the ability to deeply analyze a play, and the artistic sensibility to coordinate a compelling show, a director also needs to shape a production that will sustain itself. While in the end, directing may be among the most demanding theater jobs, it's also one of the most high-profile roles. A director is quickly lauded when a show goes well. If a production doesn't work, a director is first in the firing line. Although in the grand scheme of theater history, the role is still relatively new, the director has undeniably become a central and powerful position in the theater process.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Bells have played an important part in the history of civilizations. They've sounded the time of day, called people together, announced the opening and closing of stock markets, marked events such as weddings and funerals, and functioned as civic alarms during times of trouble. Eventually, bells were also used for music, and that tradition continues today. WRTI's Susan Lewis went to the top of three Philadelphia area towers to investigate the carillon, a musical instrument made up of many bells.
The ringing of bells is common enough. But not all bell sounds are made the same way. There are swinging bells and stationary bells, electronic bells and super bells, or rather, sets of bells played together on an instrument known as a carillon, played here by Lisa Loney for a recording at Longwood Gardens. Carillon is most often at the top of a tall tower, and there's only one way to get there, whether you begin from a center city square.
It's a lot of steps, and it gets narrow and trippy. Ugh.
On the streets of a city neighborhood.
1798, the church was founded. 1796.
Or on a leafy suburban hillside.
I love these stairs because they're worn from people going up and down it since the 18-somethings, 1880s.
At the top of the tower, anywhere from 23 to 77 stationary cast bronze bells are suspended on a large frame, often in a partially enclosed bell chamber. Each bell clapper is connected by a wire to what looks like an organ console, sort of. The keys, instead of ivories, are wooden handles called batons, and a carillonneur, like Lisa Loney, based at St. Thomas Whitemarsh, doesn't tickle them with her fingertips.
They're struck with the closed fist or the open hand. The lower bells, which may be a little bit more difficult to play because you're moving a clapper that might be about 500 or 600 pounds, are played with the feet.
The bells themselves are even heavier. Above the bustling streets of the Germantown section of Philadelphia, carillonneur Janet Tebble takes us up the steps from the playing room into the actual bell chamber of the First United Methodist Church.
Watch out, don't bump your head or bump your feet and go over there.
So we're walking under this giant bell. How big is this bell?
About 1¾ tons.
1¾ tons?
Yeah. This baby over here is 3½ tons. This is called the Bourdon, B-O-U-R-D-O-N. It's a French word that we borrowed. It means the lowest bell of a set of bells.
Tebble speaks with pride and affection for these bells she plays.
So I love being up here because of all these big bells. Now, we have 5 bells that are bigger than the Liberty Bell. Our 5th bell is the size is the Liberty Bell. There's the Liberty Bell over there. And that's an E-flat.
Because bells vibrate in circles and a single bell with its curving profile produces a tone and various overtones, each bell in a carillon must be in tune with itself and then in tune with the other bells, which also have to be the same profile or shape and material.
Otherwise, it would be like playing a melody plucked on a viola and tooted on an oboe and blasted on a trumpet. You have to have a style that matches and the same mix of bell bronze and the same profile of bell and everything else.
The result is an instrument of great power played with a lot of physical activity. Here's what it sounds like from up in the tower when Janet Tebble plays Spirochia by Jeff Rotiers. Lisa Loney finds playing the carillon quite a workout.
The hands are flying, the feet are going at a rapid pace, and we're usually working up the sweat. It's not pretty to watch, but it's, I think, a really beautiful instrument from the ground.
From the ground is where we usually listen to the bells, and carillon recitals are inevitably open-air events. Learning and practicing, by the way, for the sanity of the neighborhood, takes place on a practice console not hooked up to the bells. The music, even of a familiar tune, is distinctive.
And if you think of an organ in an orchestra hall, the organist stops playing, he lifts his hands, and you have that very slight decay of a couple of seconds as the sound reverberates. With the carillon, you have enormous decay. And that's going on and on and on. So when we either arrange for carillon or compose from carillon, we have to be very cognizant of that decay and that we don't have dissimilar notes crashing in on each other.
Carillons date from the 1500s in the Low Countries of Europe, mainly Belgium, Holland, and northern France, which, along with England, are still where most bells are made. Janet Tebble says bells were extremely important to a town.
And if a king wanted to show a town that they had fallen out of favor, they would take away their bells. And during World War II, when the Germans came in and took a lot of the Belgian and Dutch bells, that was just a horrible, horrible insult. And many bells were secreted away in the middle of the night and sunk down into canals and dug down into crypts, and we're still finding them, actually.
Carillons became popular in America in the early 1900s. From its beginnings in Europe and through the years, repertoire evolved from folk tunes to music composed specifically for carillons to contemporary compositions and arrangements in many styles, including jazz and pop. Today, Lisa Loney says the Delaware Valley tri-state area, including Princeton and Longwood Gardens, has the largest concentration of carillons in the United States. The Church of the Holy Trinity on Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia has the oldest manually played carillon in North America. Organist and choir master John French says it was installed in 1882.
The bells were cast in Belgium. They were inspected by a very famous Victorian composer at the time, Sir John Stainer, who passed off on the bells and pronounced them healthy and a good set.
Carillon playing had a revival in the early 20th century. Although it's not the easiest instrument to build, install, and maintain, Loni says her repairman comes from the Netherlands. Today, carillons do exist all over the world, including relatively new ones in Japan. Some carillons, like the one at Holy Trinity on Rittenhouse Square, have the option of electronic mechanisms.
15 years ago, the bells were in a state of disrepair and really could not be played. The bells were actually taken out of the tower and refinished and restored, and the tower was, put into good shape. They were also modernized at the time so that they could be played mechanically as well as being played manually, since we don't have somebody who goes up to the tower 3 times a day to play the instrument.
Although for most people, it's not a full-time gig. You get the sense that running up there is part of the fun of being a carillonneur.
And I love being up above the city, and I know that it's been like this since 1927, and then I have buddies all over the world who get to hang out in carillon towers too.
I'm above the tree line. It's just being inside your instrument that you play. I think it's kind of heavenly. I don't know. It's really great. I like it a lot.
There is clearly joy in this pursuit, close to the heavens, making what is perhaps the ultimate musical public art, connecting with tradition, with these massive bells, and with the world on the ground. A carillonneur never knows who might be listening, whether they plan to or not.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. There are half a dozen summer carillon concert series in the greater Philadelphia area. The First United Methodist Church of Germantown's concerts begin June 23rd and run for 4 weeks. The 5-week series of St. Thomas Church in White Marsh begins on July 1st, and the Church of the Holy Trinity on Rittenhouse Square features live carillon music before evensong services the first Wednesday of each month. Just before we go, a final word about Philadelphia Museum of Art director Anne Darnancourt. We interviewed Anne dozens of times for this program over the last 6 years, and we also shared many private conversations. I was in China with the Philadelphia Orchestra when she died, and would now like to pass along these reflections. When public figures pass, we often hear that, quote, we will never see their like again. In Anne's case, it's true. As a museum director, she was the last of a breed. She had a knowledge and love of art and a passion for sharing it. She believed that art could change lives and insisted that her museum should truly be a public museum. In this museum, she gave the public what it wanted, but also what she believed it needed. She forged creative partnerships with art institutions around the world, and in special exhibitions opened up new worlds to art aficionados and novices alike. Her interest in the world was matched by her dedication to Philadelphia. She was also a WRTI listener and member, and a strong advocate for this station's role as a key element in the cultural vitality of the region. With all her talents, Anne also had a charisma, a quick wit, and a personal magnetism. She could warm up any gathering just by entering the room. I'm grateful to have known Anne Darnancourt and will miss her. She was one of a kind, the likes of whom we will truly not see again. The Philadelphia Museum of Art is hosting a full day of events on Thursday in celebration of the life of Anne Darnancourt. The museum will be open free all day with a tribute ceremony on the East Terrace at 6 in the evening. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.